C1A Chapter 2 Atonement and Eucharist The Structure of the Christian Science Textbook Our Way of Life Number 1A
Today I would like to start and introduce the chapter Atonement and Eucharist. It's a big chapter and it's a very crucial chapter. And as I said yesterday, let's approach any chapter and let's take science and health into our hands with the right attitude, with a prayerful attitude, with that attitude which is full of expectancy, new expectancy every day. And in that expectancy, we can't help but finding and receiving more life. It's the kingdom in us which is praying, and the kingdom in us is able to receive. And let's also be clear in mind that if we do this work, that we are quite clear that we do a big job, a very big job, the biggest job on earth. We shouldn't have any reservation about this, that we are engaged in one of the most sublimest work we can do and anybody on this earth can do. Every one of us is a pioneer in the realm of divine metaphysics, of scientific metaphysics. It's a new field of discovery and we are the pioneers and each one of us is necessary. This textbook is so big and you have got the feeling with the first chapter that first chapter has yielded and yielded and yielded treasures of which we may not have been thinking of. So big, so vast. And many of you have voiced that they wouldn't mind staying on with that chapter for another few months. And that's what I can feel. So the textbook is big. And yet we have only touched that chapter from one standpoint, from the standpoint of the way of life. And as you know, there are many other standpoints in it. Just think of what Mr. Sinton does, how he shows that textbook from the standpoint of the matrix, within matrix. Think of all the many other standpoints we will find and which are necessary to discover. So what we are doing is not the job of one or two or three or a few people. It's the job of everyone. And everyone is needed. Everyone is needed. It's not the job of one carrying the burden and the other following. It's the job of each one of you being a pioneer. Now don't tell me you are not a pioneer. Don't tell me you have not enough understanding to be a pioneer. Don't tell me you are too old or too that or too that or too that. That you have not enough time and not enough this and not enough that to be a pioneer. Don't tell me that after the chapter on prayer. That's finished. We saw in the chapter on prayer that the kingdom of heaven in us prays and that each one of us has those qualities which does pray and can pray. And it is on those qualities which we build and which are piercing through the mist of mortality and ignorance into the new light of scientific metaphysics. So wake up in the morning and realize the big mission each one of you has in this world. Think of the grace that each one of us has to be a pioneer in the realm of metaphysics. And the realm of metaphysics is the only realm that will count. The whole world is, the material world is drawing to a close. Its materiality is giving way to mentality, and then we have to step in and lead mentality into divine mentality instead of letting it drift into egoistic mortal mentality. So let's look at each one of us not as a mortal, not as how old I am and how young we are, if we are a man or a woman, if we are working in a business or not, if we do housework or something else. Don't look at that. That is no factor in the kingdom of God. Look at those wonderful qualities which we have covered in the chapter on prayer, and that's the first cornerstone of manhood. Let's build on that. Let's build on that. Let's cultivate that. Let's love that. Let's nurture that. Let's nurse that. And it unfolds and unfolds. And it is leading the century. The true manhood which is going to lead the century. So let's see that we are doing something big. And when we are seeing that we are doing something big, we are also willing to put everything into this work. And then we touch atonement and Eucharist. The moment we see the bigness of prayer and see the bigness of where we are going and the bigness of promise, then something in us awakens and says, all right, then let's get up from our knees of praying and let's get up and do something about it. Let's exemplify what we are praying inwardly. Let's exemplify in our life what inwardly we are professing and confessing to God. And so we touch the next chapter of Atonement and Eucharist. You know how she introduces that chapter with the definition of atonement and says that atonement is the exemplification of man's unity with God, whereby man reflects divine truth, life, and love. She starts from the absolute truth and statement that man is one with God, of man's unity with God, the unity of spiritual man with God. Therefore, she starts from the unity of that in us which we have learned in the first chapter, prayer. That in us is one with God. And so let's exemplify that unity, that oneness with the divine. Let's exemplify. Exemplify means to show forth or to illustrate by example. And you feel at once what comes now in this chapter is that we show forth in every way and means what we inwardly in prayer have attained in the way of a spiritual attitude. So we can see that man cannot choose for himself what to do. That the true man, as we have seen it in its first inkling and its first motion in the first chapter, that man cannot but reflect God. And that he has no other possibility than to show forth what he is in his true nature. Therefore, the true man can't help, I say the true man can't help but comply really with that unity with God. He just can't help, because we have seen that those qualities in the chapter on prayer are really the first use of divinity, first use of the old mind, the one spirit of soul and of principle and life and truth and love. And those qualities are not qualities which humanly we can culture, but they are qualities projected from divinity. And therefore they carry in themselves the seed of the whole mind, the whole spirit, and the whole soul, and the whole principle, and the whole life, and the whole truth, and the whole love. They already carry in them the seed that is going to blossom and spread out and grow as we go on through the chapters. Now, in Atonement and Eucharist, Mrs. Eddy uses time and time again Jesus as the exemplifier, as the great example, exemplifying that unity of God and man. But we must be clear that she does that not in order to teach that Jesus had atoned for us, but he had only atoned for us to show us how we can atone with God. He was only a symbol, not the atonement as such. He was only an example of perfect atonement. He was not atonement as such, like theology teaches. And so we must see that atonement has to do with the Christ, and Jesus did what he did, not out of himself, but because he was impelled by the Christ. And that really not Jesus exemplifies, that Jesus only exemplifies what the Christ teaches, namely the unity of God and man. So Behind the acts of Jesus, we must see that it is always the Christ impulsion that is at work and that is working. And the moment we see that, naturally we see that Christ impulsion is a fact which is not limited to one single person called Jesus, but that it is a universal impulsion, and that therefore this atonement is universally impelling every one of us to exemplify what Jesus had exemplified. Now, before I start with the scriptural note and the first few short subjects, I thought it may be helpful first to clarify some of the main points of the whole chapter. And therefore, I have given you quite a lot of points which you can read for yourself at home. The first two pages of this questionnaire are not questions anymore. I wanted to help you and just give you the references to study at home. And what I am doing now is I go quickly through these statements, very short, because I can rely on you that at home you take 2 or 3 weeks just to ponder these statements so as to first get a proper approach to the chapter on atonement and Eucharist. First of all, I always think the best thing for a student to do when he is dealing with a new chapter is to take a few evenings free, or if he has afternoons free, doesn't matter, and just to read the chapter through from beginning to end, if possible, in one flow. And read it through 3, 4, 5, 6 times with no other purpose than just to get the touch of the chapter. Just to get the touch what's all about, without yet getting definite views on it, but just to get the touch of that chapter. And I always find that is helpful. And perhaps you remember how John Dolly used to do that with the Bible too, that when he gave the Bible talks on the different books of the Bible, how he told us that first he would read through a book of the Bible many, many times until something in him began to awake and to talk to him and give him a certain touch of what the whole book is speaking about. And I find that this method is helping us very much. Then let me go quickly through a few of these points. We see that this atonement, which is defined as the exemplification of man's unity with God, is not shared by theology. We must be quite clear that Christian Science is not giving an improved or an embellished concept of what theology understands under atonement and Eucharist. What Christian Science gives is an entirely different view than the theological point of view. She says, "Does erudite theology regard the crucifixion of Jesus chiefly as providing a ready pardon for all who ask for it and are willing to be forgiven? Then we must differ from it." Let's differ from it. Let's agree that we disagree right from the beginning. And let's put our old sense and the sense we had from theology, let's put that right aside and not try to embellish that or improve that. And let's start right new from scratch. That's the best thing we can do in any science. She says that atonement is a heart problem in theology. It's a hard problem in theology. And it looks as if it would be a hard problem in Christian Science. It looks like. And that's the difficulty of presenting atonement and Eucharist. Atonement and Eucharist is one of the most lovely chapter we have. It's that love which is strong. That love which is strong. But the human mind and the mortal mentality in us will come along and say that atonement and Eucharist is a hard problem. Because in atonement, the mortal suffers. but the divine never suffers. And because the mortal suffers because of atonement, we think it is a hard problem, and we like to sidestep it. But beneath it, and seen scientifically, it is a chapter which is impregnated with the tone of love. That love which is disciplined, that love which is strong, that love which wants to draw us to perfection with all its strength and with all its power and with all its urge. So whenever in your next week's study, especially when you read the references of the first two pages of the questionnaire, if you should get a feeling of burden and of suffering, every time that feeling comes to you, think that you turn your thought to love for yourself. So the last subject then is the biggest subject, and it's subject of love. But just to take it, to anticipate that, just always turn your thought back and think that that which stands behind atonement, which wants us to, that we go through the purifying fire, is love and not the devil. That which urges us to be weaned away from materiality is love and not the devil. And that gives you then again the tender sense which really should be predominant when studying this chapter. Jesus, as I said, is shown here in this chapter as the symbol and only as the example for atonement, showing that perfect, complete atonement is possible. He's the exemplar. But we must see in point 5 that which atones is the Christ. Therefore she speaks of the atonement of Christ reconciles men to God. That it is therefore Christ's purpose to reconcile men to God. See, it's the Christ. It's the incorporeal Christ, the word of the Christ. It isn't Jesus. And we see that this Christ has just one big aim, to draw us nearer and nearer to perfection until we are one with perfection. Therefore, this chapter will never try to reconcile error with truth or truth with error. We just have to leave that right aside. Because religious atonement would like to reconcile error with truth, would like to reconcile human rightness and human righteousness with divine righteousness, with the human concept of right with the divine concept of right. But atonement, as shown in Christian Science, doesn't do that. There is no reconciliation of truth and error. Atonement shows the laying down of error and the putting away of error, and not the reconciling of error with truth. Having seen that Jesus only exemplifies what really the Christ does, the Christ atoning men to God, we come to point 7, where we see that therefore atonement is always our atonement, that we must see that we atone, and that it is our job to atone, and that it wasn't Jesus' job to atone for us. She says, if truth is overcoming error in your daily walk and conversation, you can finally say, I have fought the good fight, I have kept the faith, because you are a better man. This is having part in the atonement with truth and love. See, she says, everyone who daily, every day fights the good fight by overcoming truth, by overcoming error with truth, is having part in the at one man, is having part in that one mind, at the one spirit, at one soul, at one principle, at one life, and at one truth, and at one love. This is having part there. So it shows we can't escape atonement. That's now the subject of the chapter, that each one of us has to atone. And so point 8 shows us a few references that there is no vicarious atonement, that we can't rely on Jesus or on a practitioner or on our parents or on the wife to atone for us. Jesus did life's work aright, not only in justice to himself, but in mercy to mortals, to show them how to do theirs, but not to do it for them. nor to relieve them of a single responsibility. So Jesus only showed how we can do it, but he didn't do it for us. You know that theology says that Jesus atoned for the sins of the whole world, and therefore it is one atonement of one human historical man, of Jesus Christ, and that we are taking part in that atonement by believing in Jesus. Whereas Christian Science comes and says, no, we take part in atonement by atoning ourselves with God, that we do that atoning ourselves. But we see the beauty of Jesus and the might of Jesus' way of work, because he showed the method to do it. Whereas before Jesus, we didn't know the method of atonement. But he showed the method of atonement just as the teacher of arithmetic shows the method of addition, so that we can do additions. But he never does the additions all our lifetime for us. And so let's see that there is no vicarious atonement. She says that we cannot expect, because of another's goodness, suffering and triumph, that we shall reach harmony. Or that we cannot, just by pinning our faith without works to another's vicarious effort, win atonement. She says the great teacher by no means relieved others from giving the requisite proofs of their own piety. She says Jesus spares us not one individual experience. Not one individual experience will be spared for us. Another suffering cannot lessen our own liability. Well, you just will go through those few references just to impregnate in your mentality the absurdity of the theological point of view of atonement, and just to establish in us the desire and the love and the longing to atone for ourselves, and not to shun any experience, and not to try to go around the fires that will exalt us, but that we go through the fire and then we get exalted. In point 9, I have a few references showing that Jesus' atonement was important to all, and that all must atone. That she says his consummate example, for the consummate example, was for the salvation of us all. See, was for the salvation of us all. But then comes only a comma and not the full stop. That only through doing the works which he did and taught others to do. Theology would stop at the comma and say, well, Jesus' example was for the salvation of us all. Full stop. And we go on and say, yes, but only through doing the works which he did and taught others to do. So, a few other statements where she says, we must go and do likewise, and all have the cup of sorrowful effort to drink. Not one is excluded. All have to go and drink it. Yea, it is the duty and privilege of every child, man, and woman to follow in some degree the example of the Master. In some degree. She doesn't say you have to do it in 3 days as Jesus, in 3 years as Jesus did it. She said, take your time. But finally, we will have to do every step Jesus did ourselves too.